Hi, and welcome to episode 479 of the MWA podcast. I'm Kyle, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Sean and Brian. Mark is on assignment. Today, we're excited to have William Boyle as our guest. Bill is a professional chairmaker and instructor, and he makes some truly outstanding Windsor chairs out of his shop in Illinois. So welcome to the show, Bill.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay. Well, at least you have a nice name that I cannot mispronounce, but I'm going to give it a try.
So there you go. Hold on, I got to check real quick. Kyle, did you just say Illinois, like pronounce the S?
Is that no, I said Illinois.
Okay, I'm just checking.
I hope so.
Kyle pronounces the L in salmon too, so just give me a break.
Exactly. You know, hey, you know, I'm from Texas. Give me a break.
I know. Hey, everything's different from where you are.
So, well, anyway, well, I'm excited to talk about Bill. Bill makes some fantastic chairs and does some teaching, and I want to really dive in deep because he makes a number of rockers, which, you know, I'm making my first rocker. So, you know, I might have some questions later on. Anyway.
And Illinois is not too far from me, too. You know, I've driven further. So,
Yes, you have. Yes, you have.
Where are you at, Sean? Where are you
Northwest Ohio, just outside of Toledo.
Oh, okay. That's not too far then.
So just down the turnpike.
Brian, how about you? Where are you out of?
I live in the southeast portion of Pennsylvania. Reading is the biggest city closest to me.
Okay. Very cool. And I know you're in Texas.
Yeah, I'm just south of Houston, so near Galveston, if you know where that is.
Mm-hmm, I do.
Yeah, across the bay from Galveston. Well, great. Well, before we talk to Bill further, let's dip our toes in the woodworking news. So, first off, Lost Art Press has started their annual anarchist gift guide. Mm-hmm. I think as we're recording this, we're on day 4, I believe.
I think 4 came out.
So. Yep. Yes.
Although, so, as a subscriber, Kyle, have you seen the whole?
Yes, I've seen the whole list. Yeah, but you want to be honest, I just kind of glanced at it and then forgot about it because I like the suspense of every day.
See, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You know, it's kind
and
of.
And I like what he does because sometimes it's super simple stuff. You know, yeah, oftentimes yeah. I'd say it's probably super simple stuff. Like,
yeah. So anyway, but by the time this publishes, we're probably through with all the posts, maybe. But if you haven't seen them yet, go back and check them out. They're absolutely great. And if you're new to the Anarchist Gift Guide, go ahead and check out, you know, he's been doing it for, at least 5, maybe 10 years now. So it's pretty good. It's pretty good. There's a lot of good stuff there. There's never really anything that's that expensive. He might have one item a year that's, you know, expensive, but most of the stuff is sub $50. A lot of it's sub $20 or $10. So, yeah.
And if you're not following the Lost Art Press blog, what are you doing?
I mean, exactly.
It's like blogs kind of died off a little bit, but this is definitely ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And next up, I wanted to, this has been out there. I've seen a couple of people mention this, but I figure we should give it a shot too. And that is some miter gauges that Sawstop has come out with. So they have two miter gauges. One is their called the Revolution miter gauge, which is, I guess, got all the bells and whistles and lets you, you know, just really dial in to the nth degree what angle you want to cut. And that miter gauge is only $450. So it seems just a little bit. It looks like a nice miter gauge, but that's a relatively steep price.
What's the cost to black anodize 80/20 rail?
Well, I don't think it's 80/20 rail.
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. 80/20 rail is not always the straightest. 80, you know, you should see some of the ones I've sent back to them. But, sent back to them. I just call them up and say, hey, this one's defective, and they send me a new one. So I got a bin of 80/20 rails.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Someday I'll make something out of them all. But they also have a less expensive miter gauge called their scale miter gauge. And it's more in the ballpark of what a good miter gauge would cost. And it's $250. But I don't think that's their miter gauge. I think it's just a rebranded Incra because this looks like the Incra HD 1000. Because it's the Incra 1000 HD.
Yeah.
Because as soon as I looked at that, I go, boy, this thing sure does look like an Incra miter gauge. And I did some comparison. And yeah, there's virtually identical, except this one is all black anodized aluminum, where the Incra is red and gold or something like that. So yeah.
I tell you what, the Revolution miter gauge at $449 would be appropriately priced if they could rig it that if you nick the blade with the miter gauge, it does not destroy your saw stop breaking.
Oh.
That would make it worth it because two out of my three trips have been nipping my miter gauge out of stupidity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Or at least they should come with the cartridge with them, you know, a couple extra cartridges. You're on your own for the blade. But anyway, yeah, that's, but you know, if you're in the market for a miter gauge, I don't know if you need to spend $450 on a miter gauge, but the other one, you know, you can find that Incra 1000 HD on them. I've seen it as low as like $200, or you can even get the Incra 1000. I think that's what I have, and I've had it forever and it's never let me down. I think you can get that for $125 to $150, somewhere around there. So and you know,
is there any boots on the ground reviews of the saw stop?
Like, there have been a lot of miter gauges out. I think Mark Spagnuolo did his miter gauge shootout about a year ago. Yeah. And I think a bunch of companies waited till he was done and say, all right, we're releasing our miter gauge now. Because yeah, Mark told it like it was. And I think his recommendation, one of his top recommendations was the Incro 1000. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, which makes sense. It's a real good miter gauge at, you know, a decent price. So anyway, but I just thought I'd highlight that. SawStop also has some cabinets that go under your table saw to store some stuff, and they're absolutely ridiculous. They look basically like your, you know, your mechanic's tool chest, but, you know, on wheels and will slide under there, you know, like, you know, the Cobalts or the Craftsman's or all those steel mechanic's toolboxes. Mm-hmm. Kind of looks like that, but I think they want like $400 and $600 for them.
Oof.
Yeah, I got two different sizes, and I was just like, yeah, thanks, but no thanks.
Nope. Yeah. Nah.
Yeah, no. And speaking of woodpeckers has a new router table fence out.
Nice segue. What are we doing here, woodpeckers? What is this cheap wood onto your normal nice red aluminum? What are we doing?
Well, this is an interesting router table fence. Now I'll have to admit that I do have a woodpecker's router table, and I do have the Super Fence, which was their top of the line fence, and it's a nice fence, and I've really enjoyed using it all these years. But I just don't use my router table that much. But if you do, this looks like a real nice fence. They've incorporated a lot of interesting features. You can adjust both sides of the fence, so the right hand and left hand side, by, I think it's, you know, by microns, if you want. I think one revolution of these screws is like 1/32 of an inch. And then they have that revolution broken down. It's a really, really nice fence. It looks like it can really adjust, but it comes at a price. It's $400 for the fence. Now, if you have the Super Fence like I do, you can buy just the mechanics of this fence for only $299 and then add that to your Super Fence. But I just don't see a justification for that, at least in my mind. I just don't use my router table that much. But, you know, it is a nice fence. I think a couple episodes ago, we talked about them having some new router lists. So it looks like they're combining a bunch of stuff that's been on the market for a while and adding some new features too, and kind of upgrading their lineup across the board, at least for some of their bread and butter products, like their router table fences and their router table lifts.
Maybe I'm just not seeing it, but, or maybe I don't use my router enough. Why would you need micron adjustability on a fence like that?
You know, on my Super Fence, I have this little micro dial where I can adjust the whole fence very, very minutely. I've used
about that. Forward, backward?
Yeah, forward and backwards.
Oh, okay.
And you can do the same thing of this. You're just adjusting both sides of the fence. I've used that like 3 or 4 times when I've needed it. And I'm not sure that, you know, I couldn't have gone with just bumping it just barely. But, yeah. You know, I go, hey, it's on here, might as well use it. But you know, I guess if you're really trying to dial in something, it might be of use, you know.
I mean, I think Woodpeckers is, you know, takes an engineering, you know, edge on a lot of their stuff that, you know, woodworking, it isn't necessarily down to the micron. You know, you're going to sand, you're going to do all this other stuff. So do you need to sneak up with super micro adjustments on something like this, or set it with a gauge block and that's good enough?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And that's usually what I do. And like I said, you know, I'm glad I have the router table, but I use it, I don't know, half a dozen times a year at this point with what I build. Now, other people build other stuff, do a lot of other things that might have moldings and all kinds of things involved, a lot of rabbets or something, and they might use a router table a lot more than I do. So, you know, this might be a good option for them. But anyway, Bill, do you use a router table much?
I have a router table, but it doesn't come into play in chair making at all.
You're right.
But I have one, and it comes up with something with the house or something once in a while, and, you know, a lift and all that over there.
Yeah.
And I got a vacuum that I can hook up in the back, because those things make a huge mess.
Yes, they do.
Uh-huh. They do. They do.
Yeah, that's one thing I got to say with woodpeckers and the router tables. They do have some good dust collection, you know, with all some add-ons that they can put in there, both at the fence. And I think they have a box that has some dust collection in it too. That's really good. But yeah, I'm with you, Bill. I just don't use mine very much. It's really good for stacking chair parts on.
It's a good a horizontal surface.
Can't make some of mine right now.
Yeah.
There's always going to be that. So, I mean, to the tune of the upgrade for Superfence is 300, the pro router table fence is 400. I mean, is it worth that? Like,
you would have to need that micro adjustability and use your router table on a daily basis for it to be worth it. I think so.
Yeah. It seems like an upgrade that's like, they're almost showing it on a, what looks to be kind of a cast iron router table. And I don't know how many of those are out in the world. A lot of people put router lifts in a lot of different things.
These say they will fit on any router table that they've made in the past, or anything that I think the slots that this thing fits in are 17 inch on center, if memory serves me right.
Okay.
So it'll work with, you know, anything you've done. All router tables are set up usually, or I think most router tables are set up at 17 inches on center. So it'll probably work on a variety of different router tables.
Yeah. But
yeah. I think if you were new to the game and you thought you were going to use a router a bunch and you were buying your first or second, you know, router table, this might be a good idea. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, if you're, if you're looking and you know, you've got nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and this is on the list and you want to have a nice setup. Absolutely. Sure. That makes sense. If you've got one already and this is just a fence upgrade for your existing thing, you know, my dad built the Norm. Does everybody know the Norm, you know, router cabinet?
Yeah.
And that has a little L bracket of fencing that you made, you know, works for what it's worth. And it had to be a lot cheaper than what this is. You know, if this is the thought of an upgrade, I don't know. It's a certain use case. If you run moldings but don't have a shaper and you're using your router table, okay, you know, you may invest in something like this because you need something that's got some adjustability, robustness, and otherwise. But yeah, it's an interesting one, kind of high dollar for what they do.
Yep. Well, anyway, it's the latest and greatest. So
of course it is.
Yes. Well, let's move on. So let's move on to our Patreon shout out. So who do we have to thank this week?
Yeah, you know, we always like to give a shout out to our Patreon supporters, and today we're giving that particular shout out to our friend Katie Thompson. Katie, thank you for your support. Yes. And if you, dear listener, would like to support the MWA podcast, you can go to patreon.com/MWA podcast and support us there.
Yes, thank you so much, Katie. Well, let's move on to what's in the shop. So, Brian, what are you working on?
So, my shop got taken over by my next door neighbor last week. He says, hey, can we use your shop? Some friends came to build something. I said, say, whatever. So he brought, it's about 100 inch movie screen with him, like rolled up. And then we built a humongous frame that was very interesting to get back out of the house. barely fit out the door. He's building a theater in his basement. And he found a good deal on a screen, just needed to build a frame. but he brought two buddies with him. One gentleman was named Jacques. I'm not exactly sure how Jacques fit into the thing, but in the past, he had been sponsored by Harvey Tools. So I just stepped back and said, Jacques, you do what you want, do what you need. And I felt very proud because I have everything that he asked for. And he's like, looking around my shop, he's like, you know, how are we going to, you know, put this particular piece together? He's like, I know I can sell a domino here somewhere. So, he was right. There's one. So we were able to do that. Turned out really well. And,
how did you get it into his basement if you had trouble getting it out of your shop?
I'm not quite sure because they kind of drifted off into the night when they left and it went over to the neighbor's yard. His basement door is actually probably bigger than mine.
Oh, okay. So
it's probably easier.
Rough dimensions, 100 inches. I mean, is this thing 6 feet tall and how wide? You know,
oh, it was bigger than
yeah,
that.
I mean,
we had to tilt it and it barely fit through the door frame when we. You know, typical French door.
Right.
So I'm not sure how you use someone itches, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what typical doors
on the slant,
six or so tall and roughly 5.5-6 feet wide. You know, on the diagonal, you're looking at like 7 feet, 7.5 feet, something like that. Like, it's not enormous.
Yeah. It was big,
but
much bigger than my assembly table. Yeah.
Yeah. That's wild.
So that was cool. I'm interested in place. So in early November, got together with Todd Neville, one of my good friends, also a Southeastern PA resident. Todd's an excellent hand tool woodworker. So Todd and I got a chance to go to New Hope, Pennsylvania and visit the Nakashima Studios. And we waited long enough that we were able to get a tour with Mira, who's George's daughter, and actually Mira's grandson. I forget what his name is, but they were able to take us to the tour. Grandson pretty quickly figured out that we were woodworkers, and we weren't allowed to unfortunately, take pictures inside any of the buildings, but we were able to stick our head into the wood shop and we saw this ginormous walnut trestle table that they were building. It had to be, 12, 14 feet long.
Wow.
And probably 5 feet wide. And Todd and I are like, how am I going to flip this thing over? It was ginormous. And then they took us into the, like a finishing shop that they were using, and they had this beautiful table I just finished with that was Peruvian walnut that I have never seen before. It was absolutely gorgeous, almost like a ribboned or a crotch pattern through it. It was absolutely gorgeous. We got to sit in a lot of their chairs, very, very comfortable. You know, they're Japanese style, so they're, you know, some of them are very low to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But they were much, much more comfortable than I thought they would be. And we got to see, you know, some of the other studios, some of the other artists that have taken part with the Nakashima family. And then Todd and I, Mira asked us, would we like to see the slab storage? And we're like, heck yes.
Yes, please.
So we went up, as we were walking up this hill, if you've ever been to the studio, it's kind of like a very gradual, grassy area. Walking up this hill, this ginormous metal pole building is there. It's probably 200 feet long, probably 40 feet wide, you know, a service lane down the center, and then slabs stacked probably anywhere from 5 to 20 feet high on both sides, all the way to the walls.
Wow.
And you know, at one point, Todd kind of went behind this one stack and he says, this slab is longer than my wingspan. You know, he's put his arms way out and it was just, you know, the tree must have been the diameter of like 7 feet. It was immense. And I'm thinking, you know, how did you get all these in here? And Mira said, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that because when her dad died, when George died, they were storing their slabs over the Thompson Wood Company. And Thompson says, you know, it's time to move these on. So that's when they built this building. But when they brought the slabs over, they kind of did it helter-skelter and just, you know, brought whatever they could fit in the truck and just threw it in there. And they wanted to reunite the trees because, you know, they were, you know, cutting the bandsaw mill.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to bring all the trees back together. And she said it took two guys full time, an entire year to go through that shop and reunite all the slabs that should be together. I was like, holy cow.
Wow.
So that was enormous. I said that to Greg Pennington and Greg's like, I have like, you know, peons compared to that place. But that was really cool.
Yeah, that was cool. Was there any reason they wouldn't let you take pictures? Were they working on new designs and stuff like that? Or
I'm not quite sure. It apparently had been that way for a long time.
Okay.
In the years, you know, pre-COVID, they were doing tours like all the time, and the shop workers found them kind of distracting.
Mm-hmm.
So they now only do them on the weekends. But I wish you did, because in the little space that you start, there's a couple stools in there. There is a writing armchair in there that has a slab, a skinny slab as a tablet, which I thought was really awesome.
Hmm.
They had a couple three-legged chairs, which I thought were unique. But you know what? Bill, you probably will find it funny. You know, I've only made, I don't know, less than 10 Windsor chairs. But when I looked at the Nakashima chairs and I looked down the spindles, some of them are still a little wonky like mine are. And I felt so much better with myself. You know, you don't have to have perfect spindles to have a perfect chair. It was a really cool experience.
Yeah. Well, you know, I should have given you some business cards or something. You know, we do have the spindle drilling guide that they might could use.
Yeah.
They might.
Mira was leaving for Japan. When she gets back, I'm going to work on trying to get her on the podcast. I think she'd be a great asset.
Be fantastic. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be cool. That'd be really cool.
So I assume they are doing new designs and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. The outside that humongous slab shed was a smaller section where they bring the slabs in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not surprising, they had a big issue with insect infestation. So they built their own kiln. So they'll come out of the big slab building into the kiln for a little bit, and then to this other slab building that's a lot smaller. And that's where the artists will start to draw out, sketch on the things, you know, dimensions, and find the right piece of wood for that design. They still do a lot of designs. And if you're curious, you can still get a Nakashima piece. It's 10 to 12 months if they're lead time, which I thought was pretty good.
That's reasonable. Yeah. Mm. Interesting. Yeah. So what'd you pick up? Or what'd you,
Todd brought one of his books for Mira to sign. I think it was, I don't know if it was Soul of the Tree, one of the other books. But they have like little things in the little meeting area.
Yeah.
And there's some really cool, almost like clawfoot carved spoons and like ladles that were in there. I almost bought one of those, but it's like $650. I was like, that's a pretty expensive spoon. So,
yeah,
but it's well worth the trip. If you can ever get down there, you know, you can't just show up and hope to get a tour. You have to get them ahead of time. But yeah, if you're in the area, sense. It's well worth it. Yeah.
Well, that was great, especially if Mira was giving you the tour. So that's incredible. So, wow.
Yeah.
You're very fortunate to be in that area to be able to do that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
How far away is that from you?
New Hope, it took me about an hour and 15 minutes to get down there.
Okay.
No, that's not bad. It's just down the street for us here in Texas.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So how long was the tour?
It was about 2 hours.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they, you know, Mira was fantastic. She gave the backstory on growing up and when they came to the country. When George went to India, he helped create the first reinforced concrete building in India, which I didn't even know that aspect.
But that, and now what you think of with like the Burj Khalifa and things like that, like,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah. And that building's still there. You can, I think actually it's a hotel now. You can go there and stay. But there's a design studio that has like this arched kind of like a waving roof. Amira was telling us the architect thought it would work and, you know, cause it's poured concrete. Mm-hmm. And when they took the on top of a form, and when they took the last support out from underneath, the guy basically like hit it and ran because he wasn't sure if the roof was going to collapse too. Obviously, it didn't. But it was such an awe-inspiring thing, and it's kind of buried in a little neighborhood,
you know?
So it's not where you would think it would be.
That's super cool.
That's my adventures, Sean. How about you?
Oh, geez, not nearly as adventurous. My gosh. No, I mean, it's fall in Ohio, so that means leaves are falling at a steady clip in a town like mine that's known as Tree City. We have a lot of old growth, maples, oaks, and otherwise. And so it's been a daily leaf pickup routine.
So all you hear is leaf blowers around the neighborhood constantly?
And I'm a little more diligent than others. My one neighbor across the street has got one of those big, like, it's a fan that you walk blowers. Like,
oh, yeah.
And it just blows everything to the side. I have a couple of different things. And I've been on my roof twice in the last 7 days, just walking my gutters, clearing them out, because I got maples that overhang my house. And so they're just littered with leaves, you know, and that's just a mess if you don't catch it before winter. But I ran a half marathon, my annual. This one I think I've done 9 or 10 times on Saturday. It's a nice fall race in the southern suburb of our area. Yeah, nothing Nothing cool. too
So how'd you do?
It's totally don't care. I've done it. Okay. I've done it all different ways. It was my first distance race,
mm-hmm.
10 years ago. And, for that one, I was recalling to my kids this week. I had given blood the week and prior, and then I ate differently and I did all these other things. I was all trained up, but I went and I conked. I was out of it. My arms hurt when you're running. That's really weird. Like, there was a whole lot of issues, and I was the worst ever I've done. I finished, but it was nearly 3 hours. You know, it just took me forever to get through that thing. I just had fun, walked when I needed to, walked the water stations and all that other stuff. You know, hour 57, I think, which is not, it's about 20 minutes slower than my fastest, mm-hmm. but not my slowest overall. So it was a fun one. It's a so familiar course. I've done it a bunch of times. I know it like the back of my hand. It's just a, you know, go and do it. It's always, the weather is always a bit of a hit or miss thing. Sometimes it's raining sideways. Sometimes it's 40 degrees at the warmest. And this one, actually, I dressed a little warmer than I wanted to, but that's all part of the game.
Well, good. Well, congratulations.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks. I got another medal on my wall. That's all it's worth. So, Kyle, how about you? Not Nakashima and not running a half marathon, I'm sure.
No. It's been busy around here. I got some work going on in the house. That vent hood over our range is finally getting that done. But I've had contractors here and doing this and that, and you know, just normal everyday stuff that just takes stuff. My mom's TV went out, so there goes a day buying her a new TV and getting that set up, and you know, doing the here's how you use the new TV and all that kind of stuff, and getting it integrated. And you know, remember the days when you buy a TV and you just plop it down and plug it in and there you go?
Yeah.
Now you got to download an app, put it on your phone, you know,
mm-hmm.
all that fun stuff. So just doing those kind of things, normal stuff. And just taking the only time I've been able to do two things in the shop. One is getting orders out. And the other thing is trying to finish up on the rocker. And by the rocker, I mean the actual rockers. So I think last episode we talked about, or two episodes ago, I was talking about how to get those perfectly even and how it was going back and forth. Well, I did follow the advice that Mark gave and did the old stick with a piece of sandpaper on one end and running that up and down the runners. And that actually did a lot better than what I was doing. And so it's got it rocking incredibly smoothly, and everything is going good. I had it when I first put it down there, it was starting to creep off to the right just barely. After about 50 rocking backs and forth, it would slowly start creeping off to the right. So I got it back where everything's going centered and really smoothly. So anyway, it is always fun. You know, it's taken forever to get this down, but it is always fun and educational to do something that you've never done before. And, you know, maybe I should have took a class on building a rocker before I actually decided to build one. But anyway, yeah, I should have gone up to Bill's place and go, hey, I need to build a rocker.
That's absolutely where I am. I'm like, I don't think I'm going to try to do this by reading something too quickly. I'd much rather learn.
Well, I mean, the basic construction is fine. You know, it's just, I've never done
You've done the
actual rocker
part
of it.
The
blades, as you would say.
Yeah. It's good that Mark's figured that out. And is that one of those things that if you're not careful, you're just going to chase it into oblivion? If it's walking to the right and you correct it, and, oh shit, I overcorrected it, and now it's going the other way.
I guess you could. I was, you know, Mark said, hey, put some 60 or 80 grit sandpaper on there. I did 150 and just, you know, I'd go, all right, I'm going to take
ease up on it.
I'm going to take 20. And what was really weird is when Mark gave me the advice, he goes, I can't remember which, you know, if it's going to the right or going to the left, I can't remember which rocker you need to sand, you know. And I was just like, okay, great. How do I figure this out? And I finally came out with the bright idea. Well, let me put three layers of tape on one of the rockers and see how that works. And then I'll know which one to sand.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. So you just figure it out by preloading it.
Yeah, preloading it and going, okay. So, and I'm going to ask Bill about this, and if he tells me I'm wrong, then maybe I just got lucky. But from what I understood was, you know, in my experiments and, you know, my final results is if it's creeping to the right, then you want to sand the right rocker. If it's creeping to the left, you want to sand the left rocker. So I don't know. Bill, is that the way you do yours?
Yeah, I kind of do. Yeah, that's something. But it's a challenge. I mean, I'm glad that you found it a challenge to do the rocker blade. that is one of the hardest things. I mean, to try to get, you want a smooth rock and no hitch in there, right?
Yeah. You don't want to hitch in the get along, so to speak. Yes. Yeah. And that really helped it out because it was rocking relatively smoothly with what I was doing. But after I did that, that really smoothed it out. And I feel bad that Mark couldn't join us since I'm heaping all this praise on his ideas. But I assume he got these ideas from Greg or somebody like that.
Yeah. Great. That's how Greg does it, with a sandpaper on like a off cut of plywood. You just kind of, you know, run over the rockers. You don't need to stand all the way across, just like that.
No. Yeah. 10, 12 inches right there where it's going to rock. Yeah. That's what I did. But, I have some long 2x4 calls that I made years ago, and they're perfectly straight. They're not calls that are bent or anything. So I just used one of those and stuck some PSA sandpaper on one end of it and back and forth. And I was, you know, I worried about not being able to keep it even as I sanded, but that seemed not to be that big of a problem. So.
So
I was extremely proud. Actually finished that up as we're recording last night, about 9:30 at night, and I had to come in and go and tell my wife, "Hey, it's rocking much good. Come downstairs. You got to try this out." So that's what I've been doing. So Bill, what have you been working on in your shop?
Well, I'm trying to get out orders too. I have been very fortunate to super busy with building chairs and classes. Right now I've got this Comeback rocker that's sitting behind me, trying to get it together. And it's an order of two that's going to Florida, two Comeback rockers. And so I'll have to build a box, two boxes I think I'm going to do, ship those down. But first they'll get finished and all that. And she's going to do a black over mustard finish on both of them.
Oh, cool.
And she wants to make sure they look old. And I whittled a couple of spindles ahead of time and did a couple of short spindles.
Yeah.
And finished one black over mustard and one black over red, and sent some high res images to her. And that's what she wanted, was the black over mustard. I got that, and I've got a settee I've been working on, which is a butternut seat, and it's a Velda settee, and from Curtis Buchanan's design. Anyway, I was about ready to get that done before these two rockers, and the crest that I bent, I tried to dry it too quickly, and ended up honeycombing the inside of that thing. I mean, it bent great and everything else. And whenever I was catching it with the draw knife, all of a sudden some holes started opening up. I got my book out about drying wood, and, you know, it's just, I was just did it too quickly, you know? And so I had to make another one, shave another one. And so I put that outside, and I'm just air drying that quite a bit in the form before I even attempt to try to dry it. And I'm going to dry it slower. But that settee or bench is ready to get put together. Most all the other parts are done except for carving the seat, which I'm looking forward to, by the way. And I don't know if any of you guys have dealt with butternut much.
I made a Velda's chair, not a rocker. You're doing a settee?
I'm doing a settee. It's a one-piece settee butternut bench, yeah.
Yeah, but butternut's wonderful stuff. Yeah, really takes a fine edge, nice crisp lines.
Yeah, I love it. And, you know, next to Eastern White Pine, but I have been doing like lots of harder wood seats. I just finished an order with ash, white ash I carved 8 of those and 2 elms and 1 walnut this summer. And it's all hand carved. And then I get into the butternut or eastern white pine with these orders, and I'm just loving it, you know.
Well, what's your carving regimen? I mean, are you using traditional scorp type stuff, or are you doing any power carving and then finishing up with hand tools, or what's your regimen?
Well, that's a good question. It all depends on what I'm working with. But mm-hmm. I'll do the adds. I got a little adds that I, you know, mm-hmm. open up with and all that. If it's I even did most of those ash seats that way, starting with the adds and then going with the scorp and on up like that. And all of a sudden I'm like, I wonder if I could use something to help me out with this ash. You know, because it takes me twice as long to do an ash seat as it does a butternut or a pine seat. And I just have to be more patient, sharpen my tools more and things like that. And so I'm looking around the shop to see what I have. And I found, I think it's a 2-inch drill bit. What do they call those?
Forstner bits?
Forstner bits.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I measured the lip of it. And if I used it in the right spot, I could make a ton of spots and not go below my depth holes. So I used a Forstner bit to open up, you know, a nice hole and everything to use my scorp with. On the last 3, I wish I'd have done that earlier. You know?
Yeah. I think of all people, Chris Swartz posted something about that years ago. He was doing something similar. I don't know if it was with the, I think it was with the Forstner bit, but I'm not certain, but it might be something to go back and look at, but it seems like you got it down anyway, but that's an interesting technique.
It worked out great to open up a nice little spot, you know, to start carving and save me probably an hour.
I love seat carving. Once you get past the scorp part.
yeah
I like doing all the fine finesse stuff, but yeah, I've found using James Mercell's Travisher instead of a scorp is working pretty well, especially in the harder woods. It really eats out the wood pretty well, so
yeah. I got one of those and I know what you're talking about.
Anyway, before I just pepper you with all kinds of Windsor chair questions, I'll let Brian get in a word edgewise. Before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you grew up and how you got into woodworking?
Well, I grew up here in Northern Illinois, and you know, most of my life, you know, around here. And I'm married and I have 4 children. 2 of those are adopted, like family adoption early. And we've had him forever, you know, forever. One since he was a year old, and one when he was 5. But it was from a family adoption. And then I have another son and a daughter. And, 3 grandkids now. And so anyway, I'm enjoying being a father and a grandfather as far as that goes. But as far as how I got into woodworking, I was thinking about that with your questions that you sent me. And it had to do with coffee scoops, carving coffee scoops. And it started with a YouTube video of watching this guy carve a nice size spoon with a hatchet.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried that and I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. Some guy doing that, you know. And, you know, you get into YouTube stuff and somehow must have been somebody was carving a spoon or a coffee scoop. And I took to that. I'm making myself one, trying to give one to my kids, you know, family. Anybody want, how many coffee scoops do you need, you know?
Yeah.
So then I went down the rabbit hole of turning and turning bowl and all that. But I never got any training on turning bowls or carving, really. So I didn't really take to that too much, you know. Pieces were falling all off the thing all the time. It was scary, you know, having catches. You know, and just it was driving me nuts, and all the mess with, you know, bowl turning, you know, it was just shavings everywhere. So anyway, that's how I got the start, you know, just it started from there and just, you know, went on to a bunch of other things.
Cool. Well, how long have you been making chairs?
I'm in my 4th year full time. So I work at this 40 to 50 hours a week with gusts up to 60. You know, so.
Well, that's cool. That's nice. That's nice. That's nice. And so tell us a little bit about, you know, some of the chairs that you build and sell. So do you have like a catalog that you normally build, or is it up to the person? And
yeah,
a little of both.
Yeah. And how it kind of goes into some of the other questions, but the chairs I build are all Windsor chairs. You know, I have thought about doing other stuff, and I've made a sample one myself of one of the ladder backs and all that, but I never really took too much to that myself, you know, is what I like to see. But I build only Windsor chairs, and that's the only thing I do in my shop every day. And so, but anyway, as far as the chairs I build, all of them, if you'll look on my website or on Instagram, you will see Curtis Buchanan's influence in all of them. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I like to do. I like to build Windsors, and I sell them, you know, all of them that I can, you know. And so and I guess you're going to ask about, you know, where I sell them and things like that, I see.
well, we can get to that. So yeah, that's, I think that's one of the things that, you know, people that are interested in building chairs, and when the bug really gets to you, pretty soon you run out of room in your house for chairs. I want to build more of them. So
you start putting them in your friends' houses, your neighbors.
Exactly. Relatives. Exactly. Kind of like when you start off with coffee scoops. You need a chair? You want a chair? I got a chair.
you need a place to sit.
Exactly. So how do you market your chairs and find customers and stuff like that?
Well, that was always a question too when I got started. I'm like, you know, this takes a lot of time to make these, and I'm hopefully, you know, trying to make a better chair all the time. And so I asked around, you know, other chair makers, you know, how they sold them, and I found out at least what works for me is I go to fine art shows in the area. Chicago, Madison, Minneapolis, I've been to, Naperville, a lot of Chicago area, you know, mm-hmm. different places, but I've even been downtown Chicago twice at Millennium Park, at Grant Park. And, but anyway, I go to these ones that, I mean, they're not cheap to get into, you know, and the expense that you have to pay to enter and, you know, your hotels and travel and everything else, but they're highly attended. They're highly attended. Like the Madison show had over 250,000 people that came through over the weekend. And so when you see this many people with, and I usually bring 9, 10, 11, 12 chairs, pre-made chairs with mm-hmm. that I have made, and, you know, an art show booth and information and a guest book log, which has been the biggest thing to help me sell chairs, is that when people come by and they are interested in the chairs, and you could tell people that are kind of admiring them versus maybe they're a prospect for a chair, mm-hmm. you know, after so many experiences. But the people that are really interested in the chair and are really considering it, but, you know, they don't necessarily come to an art show thinking they're going to spend $3,000 on a chair. So I'll get their information. I said, would you mind signing my guest book while you're here? And every single person doesn't mind doing that. If they're interested, and there's a box on there if they want to be contacted later. And so all I need is really their name and email address. And as soon as they leave, I start writing notes about what they were interested in or what they said or something personal that I learned about them. And so after the shows, I start sending emails to the people that signed the guest book, you know, touching base, you know, seeing how serious they were about, you know, getting something going. And I have had many, many sales by communication that way, by following up after the shows.
Yeah. Well, that's brilliant, especially if you have a little tidbit about what you learned they were interested in and something like that. You can, you know, yeah, that's hey. Yeah, I know who you are, and I appreciate who you are, and those kind of things. That goes a long way into making those sales, I imagine.
Yeah, and I typically, my average is I'll sell two chairs at every show, whether it's the ones that I have made or custom orders. And that has been bigger than selling the pre-made chairs. People want something, they're going to spend that kind of money. They want it especially made for them. You know, they want to maybe make some choices or have some input. And they don't mind waiting, you know. And so I'll collect the deposit on the chair order and work with them. And I take photos throughout the build process. As I'm building their chair, I'll take photos in process, but I don't send them to them. Whenever they come to pick up the chair, I'll put together a multimedia presentation and an unveiling for them to make it kind of a buying experience.
That's fantastic.
This is quite the setup. I don't think I've ever heard anybody taking this approach in the chair world.
Yeah.
So I like doing that. And then last year, I started teaching Windsor chair classes here in my shop. And that's how I get a lot of the students, too, at the shows, because I'll put up signage about signing up for classes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's great. So tell us a little bit about the classes. Are these, how many students are there? And, you know, what types of chairs do you teach?
Well, what I do, Kyle, is I teach one student at a time in my shop.
Okay.
That's all I take is one at a time. And I do that for two reasons. One, I don't know that I could personally handle. I mean, I could probably handle two, you know, with the intensive. You know, chair making is pretty, I mean, it's time consuming and there's a lot to it. And people have different levels of experiences in woodworking. And so my idea and what has worked so far is that I don't care if you have zero experience or if you've made several chairs, you can come to my shop and I'm going to work and make sure, you know, we're going to have goals. And I let the student pick which chair they want to make, which lumber or timber that they want to use in the chair. And so it's kind of, we start from the beginning with a blank slate. And not only that, everybody gets to turn all of the parts. And so in my heart is that the person that comes here, that they build the entire chair themselves or rocker. And if they can't, you know, I'm building chair parts along with them. And so if they have to use some of my parts, they can use some of my parts. If they get nervous with the turning or something like that, I can get in. And I don't care if I build 90% of the chair or rocker, that they are going to leave at the end of two extended weekends with a chair that they built as much of it as they can, but also took their skill level from where it was to a much, much higher level when they leave.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. That is very interesting. And I think that's an interesting approach too, especially the one-on-one stuff. And, you know, it's very rare that you go to a chair class that you turn your own parts, you know, it's, that doesn't happen all the time. And so that's absolutely, that's cool. That's cool. I'd recommend if someone wants to learn how to build a chair, check out Bill's stuff, because that seems like interesting stuff, especially the turning aspect of it, because that's always one of the things that kind of is a mystery to people just getting into the chairs. How are you turning the parts? How does that go? And, you know, I'm self-taught, but I haven't turned that many chair parts. I've turned a lot of jigs, so I think I'll be okay. But, you know, when I do turn a chair part, it's like, okay, wait a minute. Where am I? What do I got to do? Okay, this is a different animal at some point in time. But yeah, that is very interesting. Now, about your classes. So, and about your classes, not only and your customers too, where are people going with the Windsors? Are they wanting the more contemporary Windsors like the Veldas and stuff like that? Or do you see people wanting more of the traditional stuff?
Well, that's a good question, and it feeds both into what people are purchasing at the shows and having me build. It has come in waves. Like I have built a lot of the Velda style or the contemporary style, and for a long, long time, and I'm like, I can't wait until I can build a traditional chair. And then here, you know, I get an order for two Windsors here, and some of the students have built the I've had the last student built a comb back rocker with carved knuckles and everything.
Wow.
And it was a very difficult class, and we went over, you know, the hours that I had allowed for the class. But I think it's a mixture with more into the contemporary, the Velvets. It's, I would say at least 60-40, maybe even 70-30 contemporary. Yeah.
Yeah, because if you're doing the more traditional one, especially when it comes to attorneys, they're a little bit more involved and complicated.
Yeah, a little more complex.
Well, what I learned there, I'm glad you brought that up, with the guy that did the comeback, he wanted the baluster turnings. He wanted the carved knuckles. He wanted it to be a rocker and all this. Well, we ended up doing over 100 hours of the 80 and under that I allot for this. So I learned something, and we talked about it afterwards, a class review, that if somebody wants to do one of these, they're going to do the simpler turnings, the double bobbin turnings, you know, or something like that for that chair, and not have carved knuckles. You know? It just went too much time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that is interesting. So I'm going to deviate a little bit and ask you a little bit, and maybe I should have made this a little bit more clear before we go on, but I kind of want to get some of your setup. So you mentioned you're doing steam bending and, of course, drying and stuff like that. So what is your steam bending setup? What do you use?
Well, I have two. If I'm for the Windsor chair parts, I use a stainless steel tube. I think it's, I'm looking at it here now, maybe a 6 or 8 inch diameter. And I went with a stainless steel second. I mean, I used something else like the piping that you would use in your basement. And it ended up kind of staining the wood more, that plus the water choices I was using. But anyway, I use a stainless steel tube, and I have it insulated with that foil type insulation. I have it wrapped around it. And the way I have it set up is I have it set up in the wall over here, not being used. And when I want to use it, I take it outside and put it on top of my garbage can, strapped down outside on top of it, just kind of like so it's balancing. Because the thing is 6, maybe 5 foot long.
Okay, yep.
5 foot long, you know. And so anyway, then I'll use the wallpaper seamer and that, and I have it plugged up with two pieces that I turn, like caps.
Yeah.
Okay, and then inside of it, I have like some half-moon type pieces of butternut so that pieces can set up higher into the steam a little bit more. So so that's that one, and then that's the workhorse of all of the Windsor chair parts. And then I built another one for these bent stool seats I've been making.
Yeah, those are pretty cool. Yeah, I like those.
I had to build a big box, box for that one. And I needed two wallpaper steamers for that.
Okay. Yeah, and I noticed you're using like a press to put those. I forgot what you call that, a machinist press?
A machinist press. If you want it, like I got it at Harbor Freight, if you wanted to press some bearings out or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it worked out real well for those. That was the only way I could figure out how to bend them, because that order came in off the website, and I had a customer come here, and they brought a couple of bent stools that they had purchased 20 and 30 years ago from some maker from the old country. That's all they said, but he's not there anymore. Could I duplicate it? Duplicate the bent stool seat? And I said, well, I'll try. I'd love to try. And so that guy had some sort of a glued up seat. There was like four pieces in the, let's say, 20 inch wide seat, or it's only about 16 inches wide, or 15 at the final. But anyway, there's four boards, and they were glued together or something. I could not figure out how to bend that kind of a bend in a stool after it was jointed boards. You know, I failed. So finally I went down and got some greenwood planks and, you know, from my lumber guy, and, you know, steamed those, because it was greenwood then, and it was single board seats. And then I used the press, because then how do you bend that, you know, a 17 inch wide board. So then the press made easy work of it, and it's got a pneumatic bottle jacket.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. So are you using that now to bend your crest rails and stuff too, the press?
I didn't do it that way. I've done it, but I've done the Velda's because it's the same radius as the Velda crest. Yeah, okay. So I did a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
With that. But the last couple, I think I used the regular bending strap and things that I have.
Okay. So do you use the, so when you're bending, are you using the strap as well as the winch type setup?
I wished I had the winch. Yeah. I didn't have the room for it until now, but no, I did the whole, extra board and brought it over.
Okay. Yeah.
Strap. Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a winch that I have a winch setup that's integrated into my bench. So I actually use my dog holes as part of the whole setup.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it breaks down to a relatively small footprint that I can store in the corner. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah, I've used it. Well, I make jigs, not chairs, but I've used it 4 or 5 times and yeah, it works really well. So I'm always interested about chair makers and their different techniques and stuff, but yeah, I haven't heard of the stainless steel steam box. That's unique.
Yeah.
Bill, do you? Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
The steam box, is it leaky enough that you're not accidentally making a big pipe bomb?
Say that again.
Like, is it leaky enough with the steam to not accidentally make a big pipe bomb?
Oh,
it needs to be, right?
Yeah. I'm just thinking like
enough steam.
Because a lot of people who make the steam boxes the first time, you know, make them airtight by accident.
Right.
And, you know, that can obviously become a big issue.
I never thought about that, but you're right. I imagine it could. I mean, but there's plenty of steam leaking out here and there.
Yeah. So same with mine. Mine's PVC. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah. Mine's a PVC too. But yeah, it's got enough holes in it and enough, you know, none of the joints are that tight except for the ends. So yeah. Not too bad. But
you asked about drying the wood too.
Yeah. That was my next question.
Okay. Okay. Well, you said it before. All right. Good. Well, it worked out really well the way I have it built up here in the shop. I have two cabinets that I had bought. I think it was at Menards. You know, regular cabinets like with drawers and mm-hmm. doors and everything. And I got them. I don't know, maybe 8 feet apart. And in the middle, I have a 3-foot section or so that I left between them. And so I built the kiln inside in between underneath my counter, you know, mm-hmm. the bench top over there. So it's kind of a built-in kiln. And I used to use light bulbs, but now I'm using those ceramic reptile-type heaters.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think everyone's going to have to switch over to those because you're not going to be able to find the light bulbs for too much longer.
I have a stockpile of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, there's gold in those incandescent light bulbs.
Terribly inefficient incandescent bulbs.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I went
supply heat because of their inefficiency at lighting.
Yeah, the heat is awesome, but I went to ceramic because they last a lot longer.
Yeah,
they do. Yeah, I use the same thing, and I always feel better because, at least in my mind, it's going to take a lot longer to catch fire if it falls in those ceramic things than it will mm-hmm. in an open bulb. At least that's my theory. I don't know if that's correct, but
yeah, mm-hmm. you're probably right. Sounds logical, anyway. Especially mm-hmm. if something, yeah, it sounds right. So anyway, I'll have to look into those as soon as my bulbs burn out. So anyway, but I made this nice strip that holds my bulbs and all this kind of stuff, you know, darn it. Well, anyway, so, since you're doing the class and you're doing the teaching, I think it might be interesting if folks heard from you, what is the one thing you wished you knew when you were starting out?
Oh boy. That's an interesting, I saw that question that you'd sent over, and that was one of the hardest ones for me to think about, Kyle. I mean, there's all kinds of things that I know now mm-hmm. that I didn't know when I first started. Like one of the things is, when we get to this later, you know, I purchased one of your, a lot of jigs you have.
Mm-hmm. And
those have made my job so much easier, you know, and more enjoyable.
Yeah.
like when I first started out, I'm learning from Curtis, and I've got protractors and, you know, rubber bands and mirrors and, you know, holding all these stretcher parts and all that. And like, that is like the super hard way, you know, but I do know how to do all that stuff, you know? So it's like, do I wish that I would have started with your stuff, you know, and not known that? I don't know. You know, it's, you know, we go through life and go through our experiences for reasons. And, I don't know what it is. I mean, my job, you know, I'm a better chair maker now because of the years than I used to be, you know, because of all the experiences. And not only that, it's part of the reason why I went into teaching is because I always heard that if you're instructing anything or trying to teach a subject to someone, that you start learning that subject so much better. And one of my things that are driving me is my motivation is I want to be a better chair maker tomorrow than I am today. And teaching has helped me do that. I have learned so much from my students in different ways in life because we're all individuals and unique to the core. You know, there's nobody else like you, Kyle or Sean, you know.
And true story.
Yeah. But it's a really cool thing. And so it has made me become a better teacher because I have to, if I don't know how to communicate a subject or whatever that next thing is, you know, I need to learn that, you know, I need to read and study and, you know, ask questions of other people or something like that. And so, you know, that, I don't know where I got off that tangent, but I couldn't answer your question too much about, you know, the one thing that I wished I knew before I started out. But I mean, I guess that's a cool thing that I learned that I didn't know I was going to learn is that I enjoy people. I enjoy learning from others and just not only just with chair making or woodworking, just in life in general, you know, because we all have our own unique, unduplicated path in life.
Well, that's fantastic. That's a great answer to the question. So that's fantastic. And the one reason, if you don't know why I came up with the jigs is, I'm actually pretty good at drilling and doing all that stuff. That was never an issue with me, but the first time I attempted to do a box stretcher, the stool I was working on, it came out more as a parallelogram than a box stretcher.
Oh, geez.
Not that anyone would really notice except for me, you know, it's one of those chair making things. I know it's not, you know, square, but after that I was just and that's when I tried that direct drill method, you know, I think been around for a while, and I went, well, I'm not doing that anymore, and I'm gonna, you know, just take my legs out of the chair and, you know, do them on the bench. And then, you know, I just happened across something that Curtis had in one of his videos on doing an armrest. Well, it's actually drilling the into the back post, the hole for the armrest, and he had this little contraption, which he didn't use in the video, but he just kind of showed it. And I went, oh, that will work for stretchers. That will solve my box stretcher problem. Boom, boom, boom. So
that's how you came up with it. Yeah. Well, it's ingenious. It's awesome. You know?
Yeah. And then one thing led to another, and here I am. So anyway. And that little segue was brought to you by bbcustomtools.com. Again, that's bbcustomtools.com. No, but well, before we let you go, tell us a little bit about your shop. And now, for those of you who can't see Bill in his shop, we can. And looks like a nice shop. Looks like you got two lathes sitting there in the background. So tell us a little bit.
Yeah, I do. The first one that you see, the white one, is a Jet, it's 1236, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's been workhorse up until this year, where I got this this one behind me, this Rikon, 70-30-40, I think it is. Yeah, and that is like a Cadillac, you know, three horse. I had to get 220 electricity in here.
Right.
For it and everything else. And it's just so enjoyable to use. And I guess I could do some pretty big bowls on it if I wanted to, which I don't. I mean, I'd like to like try, you know, somebody to train me on doing some bowls in here. But really, it's so that's that. That's my lathe. You asked me about that. So I'm glad you asked about the shop, because I just had went through some heavy thinking about my shop. In my shop is I commandeered the third car garage. So I walled it off. I've got it insulated everywhere. You know, there's a one of those vent-free gas heaters. Mm-hmm. So I could have it up at 80 in January and February in here and be in my shirt sleeves if I wanted to. But anyway, what it has been is kind of a tight space in some degrees with chair making. Not really with just me, but when I started adding the classes.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I've had two people in here, you know, like husband and wife, things like that. And so, and we work around the way I had it set up. So I started thinking about maybe building a shop next to the house. And then this is pretty new information. Like about a month ago, I started going down these thoughts, and I did all kinds of thinking about it. And I wanted to kind of go for it. And my wife was a little bit reserved, you know. And so, you know, we're a team, we're a partnership, and I want to make a good decision. And so it wasn't the right time. So, but what it forced me to do was to go through this shop and go through absolutely everything that's in here and say, you know, is it for chair making? Have I used it in the last year or two? If it's not, it needs to go into the basement. And so I started from one corner of the shop, vacuumed everything, took everything out, hung it to where it needs to be. So everything has a place in here. And it's, you know, putting it back after I'm using it, all the tools and things like that. And so then I cut down my bench. You know, it was too long, you know, so I cut it down on both sides. I took my power tools out of here that I wasn't using for chair making. Like I got a contractor's table saw. I've got, you know, a planer. I got a jointer. And there is a miter saw, too, that was over in here. I took it all out and used the other. I took some space away from the family side of the garage where the power tools are over there. And if I need to use them, which is an occasion in chair making I do, like the rocker blades, I'll use the planer from time to time. But mostly things are handled with the bandsaw, which is in here. So I have so much more room, Kyle, in my shop right now. I have my little office set up here, too, you know, in addition to that. You know, I cut down this bench so that I have double screen computers and everything else in here that I have to cover up if I have to sand anything or turn anything. And so I got a shave horse in here, and then the other one is in the other side that I can use when I have a student. And by the way, my classes are, I do only one per month, the first two weekends of every month.
Okay, I was going to ask you, like, yeah, they're like, how often, how long?
Yep, they're extended weekends. We start at 3 o'clock on Thursdays and go until 9, and then 12-hour days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Wow.
And make all the parts the first weekend, yeah, and then come back and do the same schedule the subsequent weekend and assemble the chair.
Mm. Okay, that's pretty cool. That's a nice program.
Yeah, it's worked out pretty well, you know, for me and the students, I think, to do it that way.
Yeah, cool.
Good. Have you had any problems with, you know, getting the spindles to dry or getting everything prepped so they can dry for the time in between? Like the students getting too far behind or anything? Okay.
No, I haven't had any of that because we'll do like the crust and the spindles the first day or two, you know, and then they'll air dry in the shop, you know, Friday evening, Saturday, and all day Sunday, and then before they leave at 6 or 7 o'clock Sunday evening, then they go in the kiln, and then we could bring them out on Thursday, and they're all dry, you know. So,
That makes sense.
So, I think it would for like a 5-day class, you know, for people and stuff, you know, like 4-day, 5-day class.
Yeah,
you know, there the whole time. I think it would be difficult, harder.
Yeah. Yeah, I know there are a lot of chair classes where you're doing the work for the next class. Yeah.
Yeah. Not a big fan of that, but
yeah. No, I've heard that on some. Yeah, you do a lot of the grunt work for the next class, which the previous class did for you. So yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, well that is cool. And that's a nice little break too, as far as folks, because, you know, I've been through a number of classes that were, you know, 5-6 day classes, and it becomes after that third day, it's like, you know, it's like, hey, I could use a break.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. I like that. I like, now, do you get many students from outside your area because of that?
Yes, I do. And it has to fit the right person, right?
Right.
Because, I mean, all of this stuff does.
So, I'm asking for Sean.
Yeah, for Sean.
There you go.
You come in, and what they do is, like, I had one guy came from Minneapolis, but he stayed in, he had some family in Chicago.
Right. So
in between, he did, but he was retired, you know, mm-hmm. you know, and so things like that happen. And, but most people stay in the hotel during the weekend. That's 3 minutes from my shop. And then, they'll go back home where, you know, where it was, but not from other states. It's around in the area, like Madison, Milwaukee, Chicago area.
I mean, what you're talking like, hour and a half, 2 hour radius.
Yeah, hour and a half. Like, I don't want them to go back from the day to day class, but during the break, then they can go back and, you know, deal with their life.
Right.
Whatever, have a job or whatever.
Right. Easy for those with family in the area or, mm-hmm. or all those things. Yeah. I mean, I have an office in the area. Well, yeah. I guess relatively Chicago area.
Yeah, then you can do that.
go do this, go to work for a week, and then come back.
Yeah, exactly.
Figure that one out.
There's a short waiting list for classes.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, before we let you go, tell us a little bit about some of your other pursuits outside of woodworking.
Well, I'll tell you, I thought about that too. this is interesting because... I do have lots of interests, and I've done lots of things in my life. In fact, Sean, I saw you were a runner, and I used to be a runner, and I used to be an athlete.
I don't want to begrudge Marines, but isn't it like once you are, you know, thing kind of like.
It is, except for when you're a chair maker full time.
Yeah, sure.
It takes so many hours to produce what we do, you know, and I've added up the dollar value per hour. It's extremely low in my opinion. I mean, I'm a commercial insurance agent that I'm retired or semi-retired from for 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if I would just spend the time doing insurance that I spent in chairs, you know, I mean, the financial factor would be so much greater, you know.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
But I don't know where I went down that tangent. <would you guys?
laughs> Welcome to the show.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But, so outside of woodworking, you do more woodworking.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, right now, I mean, there's, I'm helping out my wife and my family, you know, go through some things. My daughter is buying a house. So, in fact, today I did help with a gate, you know, put up a gate so that their dog can run backyard. But I used to be a runner. I'm a private pilot.
Oh, cool.
Oh, that's really cool.
I pushed the pause button on that. I'm not doing any flying, but I've got the license.
You're still maintaining your certification.
Yeah.
I mean, all I got to do is take a physical if I wanted to get active and go up with an instructor for like 10 hours.
But did you ever own your own plane, or did you just?
I joined a club.
Okay.
Here in town, they have a club that's been in existence since the 50s. Mm. And a bunch of guys, you know, flying's expensive and everything else. And so we all belong to the club. You pay dues. And it was not much money to get in. And you pay dues to maintain the planes. And if anything goes wrong with them, they're fixed. But there's two of them, and you just take them out, you know, with a scheduler and everything else like that.
Yeah. So have you ever gone, like, on a weekend vacation, just flown yourself to some place that's easier to get to by plane than car?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's fun. It's a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun, a skill to learn and everything else like that, you know, but, I don't know that I'll get back into it too much. I'm going to be 59 in January. It's a lot to staying current and everything.
Yeah.
No,
I used to work with a guy that was, he was a private pilot. He also rode a crotch rocket motorcycle. You could tell the guy was just a he was an adrenaline junkie. He's like, I love it, you know, and everything other than his desk job, you know, he lived his life to the fullest. It was kind of interesting to watch, but I get it. It's you might age out of that a little bit, you know, at some point.
Yeah. Well, I'm right there with you. I'll be 59 in August. So.
Oh, look at you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'll never turn 60 though, because, you know, I'm starting to count backwards.
Is it like you're 30? Like I'm 29. Yeah. I'm always 29. You're going
to
be always
29. No. You never hit 60. You go to 59, then you go to 58 and 57.
Oh, you keep going backwards. Holy crap. Yeah. Oh, what joy I have to look forward to.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, with that, let's move on to our fortnightly beer choices. So I'll start us off. I'm just drinking my normal podcast brew, which is some Guinness. So nothing exciting there, but I'm sure, Brian, you have something exciting.
Yes. So I'm traveling for work. I'm in Augusta, Georgia at the moment. Got into the hotel somewhat late, and the beer selection at the hotel is terrible. So I'm drinking a ginger ale and I'm very sad about it. I'm sure I will remedy that tomorrow at a big work dinner.
But yeah.
For this time being,
are you not like me? Like anytime we stay at a hotel, I look for the nearest whatever and, you know, like find a way to walk a half mile to the nearest beer store or something to get something local and have it in the room.
Well,
maybe that's a sign of a problem. I don't know.
No, I'm not sure. I'm sure of the area that I'm in. There was some semi-sketchy neighborhoods on the way to the hotel.
Oh, okay.
Maybe I'll check it out during the daylight.
I can't believe a town like Augusta that I see on TV at that golf tournament. It could be anywhere, you know, unsafe. Yeah.
Augusta is like a tale of two worlds. There are multiple beautiful mansions here that are multi-million-dollar properties. You turn the corner and there are tiny barred up homes. So there's a big economic disparity here for sure.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, but I'm trying to remedy it tomorrow. And we'll see how it goes. Yeah. Sean, how about you?
And it's always delicate too for you because you're traveling, because like tomorrow is tomorrow, but then you're flying out the next morning, so you can't get, you know, you're not going to take a six pack on the plane with you on the way home, you know. So
that's what check luggage is for.
I suppose. No, so I am it's a seasonal thing. Christmas in November is not okay. I agree. I'm on that thing. I don't decorate my house until after Thanksgiving, but.
So you're drinking a Christmas beer, are you?
I am. So a local brewery called Mummy Bay Brewing Company. It's around Toledo. They have a Christmas beer. It's like a spiced ale called Blitzen. I had it on Saturday after my race at a restaurant near where the finish line was. And it's kind of our tradition to do that because this is it's a November race every year and da, 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 da. Mm. And on tap, you order in the restaurant with a cinnamon sugar rim, you know, it's like, that's a total like seasonal thing. But you can get it in six pack cans at like the Kroger, you know, down the road. Mm-hmm. So, I'm totally drinking Mummy Bay Blitzen. So if you're in the area, you know what I'm talking about. Go get yourself some. It actually is a really good, like, you know, like a winter spiced ale.
Yeah.
You know, cool. It's got that kind of warm, you know, cinnamon kind of going on in it. It's pretty good. So, Bill, how about you?
Well, you know, one thing that you guys find out about me, I like espresso. That's what I'm drinking.
Whoa. Hold on. Checking the clock.
Yeah, I know. That is a big mistake, but I did get very long of a nap today. I'm an early riser. I mean, I get up crazy early, and I don't have much of a schedule, you know, that I have to keep. So if I'm not tired, I'll get out in the shop and I'll work, you know. But I'll have to have a nap during the day at some point. But if you come to one of my classes, you'll find out I schedule an afternoon espresso break.
Nice.
So I'll be here at the house.
Fair enough. I'm a black coffee drinker. I don't get a whole lot of espresso in my life by any means. But I totally respect the afternoon coffee influx. As last Saturday I ran in the morning and then there was football on and I had a beer or two and then I went out and worked in the yard afterwards and I realized at like 8 o'clock at night I was done. Absolutely done. And yeah, I woke up the next morning. I'm like, I didn't have any coffee in the afternoon. Maybe that's why.
But what was it? I think it was a couple of years ago that Wilbur Pan and his wife, they never drank coffee. You know, I don't even think they drank tea. I could be wrong about that. But all of a sudden, they tried some espresso when they were overseas, and now they're the biggest espresso fanatics.
You know? He's got the coolest espresso maker.
Yep.
It's really stovetop and space-aged all at the same time. It's really, really cool.
Yep. Yep, it is.
Part of our pantry redo is going to be a coffee bar, espresso machine shopping now.
You need to talk to Wilbur. Yeah, he's tried them all. So
get it. He said, I mean, even though it's like a one-time thing, a one at a time thing, he's like, it 10 minutes and you've got it and it's cleanable.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. That's awesome. It's expensive.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's about $1,000 or something.
No, it's like 500.
Oh, 500, yeah.
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 Oh no! Yeah. Espresso machines can run you. I mean,
three,
4,000, you know, easy.
Yeah.
Especially if you want an old school Italian espresso, you know, hardware. Yeah.
And if you're looking at like frothing milk for the topping or anything like that, I mean, there's other considerations, I suppose. But like, if you're just talking about brewing boilers, the bean, it's that thing is slick. I looked into it, and it's really tempting. I don't drink a bunch of espresso, but it's really cool.
Well, Bill, I'm gonna come to your place. We're going to make a velvet chair and have a cortado.
There you go.
Well, cool. Well, let's move on to where folks can find us on the interweb. So, Bill, where can folks find you?
Well, you can find me at William Boyle Chairmaker on Instagram or my website at williamboylechairmaker.com.
Fantastic for snagging both of those.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's good. Pretty good.
Nice thing with short names.
Yes.
You can do that.
So, Brian, where can folks find you?
Instagram is the place to find me at Obst Woodworks. And Obst is just simply OBST. Kyle, how about you?
You can always find me on Instagram at Barton.Kyle or BB Custom Tools, bbcustomtools.com, or on YouTube under Kyle Barton and BB Custom Tools. So, Sean, what about yourself?
Well, you can find me on most social medias at SeanW78.
And that just about wraps it up for this show. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. And while you're there, please leave us a review. You can follow us on Instagram at MWA_podcast. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go over to patreon.com/MWA podcast. But the best thing you can do is tell a friend. Word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion.